Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, we revisit the American Revolution through the lives of the loyalists, those loyal to Great Britain. Who were they and what became of them? Then, America at a political, cultural, and economic crossroads. What are its options? Finally, are some green solutions unhelpful for the environment, or worse, do they actually harm it? Who were the tens of thousands of people who remained loyal to Britain during the American Revolutionary War, and what happened to them? Among the one quarter of all American colonists who decided to stay loyal to the king in 1776, there were at least 20,000 slaves and free people of African descent. Where did they go after the war? And what do their stories tell us about American history? We're joined by Harvard history professor Maya Jasanoff, and we're talking about her latest book, Liberty's Exiles, American Loyalists in the Revolutionary War. Welcome, Maya Jasanoff.
Great to speak with you.
It's great to have you. So you have been looking at this aspect of American and British history that hasn't been looked at really very closely, and that is that there was a very large, what we call loyalist community, that is people that were loyal to the British crown, during the American Revolution. And it wasn't really a small number. Tell us about this community.
A lot of Americans don't realize that our revolution was really a civil war. It was our first civil war. And it was a war that divided people up and down the colonies as they were then around the question of whether to be independent. And so for the average American at the beginning of the American Revolution, the default position was actually to stay loyal to Britain. And up to maybe a third of Americans are believed to have been loyal to Britain throughout the war, not necessarily gone along with the patriot vision of independence and freedom and so on that we think of as having been so widespread in retrospect. But for them, really, staying with the status quo, staying with Britain was something that was very powerful and important to them.
That brings up a few questions. One is really the role of people like Thomas Paine, who allegedly was this person who reframed the entire idea of independence and revolution in a way that made it seem honorable rather than treasonous. So apparently it didn't work with all people. Why do you think that is?
I think that Thomas Paine, who was himself British, did do something amazing for Americans, as did Thomas Jefferson in the opening of the Declaration of Independence. And I think that they put a language to the cause of independence that had not been there before and that really gave American patriots a rhetorical advantage over Britain in the Revolution. That said, rhetoric is not the same as daily life, and it doesn't put food on your table, and it doesn't look after your family, and it doesn't govern the kinds of relationships that you have in your home, in your business, and all the rest of it. And so I think for many people living in the colonies at that time, while this rhetoric was very, very seductive and obviously went on to have a great resonance in and beyond our nation, there was still a powerful sense of the ways in which they wanted to have lives for themselves that could have profit and could have political coherence and could protect them from threats around the world. And those were all goals that many Americans continued to see held out for them in the crown of Britain and remaining part of the British Empire.
You noted that a lot of the people were members of the Anglican Church. Many of them were connected to the imperialists. But there were other kinds of loyalists there as well. It seemed like there was a diversity of them, including the people of African descent, something like you said, 20,000 slaves, and also free people of African descent. Talk about the various kinds of loyalists, so-called loyalists, and
sure,
their various reasons.
We in America usually think of loyalists as having belonged to a very small elite, as having been predominantly white men in positions of power, Anglican, strong ties to Britain, wealthy for the most part. This was in fact only a subset of who loyalists were, just as it was only a subset of who Americans were. And one of the things that is really important to know about loyalism at this time is that it cut right across the spectrum of early America. It cut across the ethnic spectrum, the geographical spectrum, the religious spectrum, and the spectrum of occupations and all the rest of it. So people had their own reasons for staying loyal that could come out of belief, pragmatic calculation, and also opportunities. And this is where the story of a group of African Americans called the Black Loyalists is particularly fascinating and important, I think, for us to look at. We know that in the United States there was this wonderful language of freedom, independence, liberty, that celebrated by Paine and Jefferson and more, but it didn't extend, of course, to the 500,000 slaves who were held in the U.S. at that time. Instead, many of them saw liberty offered to them by the British Empire, and early in the war, just a few months after the American Revolution began, British commanders began issuing promises to patriot-owned slaves in Virginia and elsewhere, telling them that if they came and joined the British, then they would get freedom in exchange for doing that. And so for them, the promise of liberty was really held out by Britain and the Empire, and about 20,000 black slaves ended up joining the British, and a good half of them survived the war and ended up being evacuated in freedom at the war's end to live out liberty in the British world.
And there were also several thousand of the free people of African descent as well.
Yes, and in particular, these slaves who became free as a result of British promises. And British commanders really, in quite an admirable gesture that I think has been neglected by historians, really stuck up for the freedom of these people in the face of great American opposition. And in fact, George Washington himself confronted the British commander at the end of the war, saying, "You guys are taking away our property," as he saw the former slaves. And the British commander stood up and said, "Look, you know, these are free people, and I'm not going to take their freedom away from them." And George Washington was very put out by this. Not least, some of his own former slaves went off into the British Empire and had new lives. But the fact is that Washington's vision of freedom and liberty did not apply to and did not extend to these formerly enslaved people.
So given the extent of the people that were loyalists, you said it was one-third of the people settling in America. That's a huge number. So what accounts for, you've got the British Army, which was very strong. You've got one-third of the people living there siding with the British Army, and they still lost.
Yes, it is one of the great what-if questions in certainly British imperial history. There are really a couple of things that account for why loyalists didn't win the day. And I do think that that rhetorical advantage that the U.S. had was very powerful. And I also think, and this comes back to the issue of civil war, at the end of the day, British people living in Britain and colonists of British extraction living in the 13 colonies shared more than divided them. And when faced with this potentially protracted, bloody, divisive war, I think many people on both sides really had a kind of lack of will to keep fighting it out when they could find ways to redefine the relationship peacefully. So by the time the Americans had this kind of coherent sense of who they were going to be, the British were interested in trying to find a kind of common ground with what became the United States.
Now, here in the U.S., we are taught about the spirit of 76. You talk about the spirit of 1783. Tell us about that.
So one of the great paradoxes about the American Revolution is that Britain lost this war. It was the biggest loss of territory for the British Empire until the era of World War II, until the whole empire fell apart in the 20th century. And yet, it was Britain, not the United States, that went on to be the big world power throughout the 19th century, up until, in fact, about World War II. So how could it be that Britain lost these colonies, these closest possessions, very valuable culturally and politically, nevertheless go on to kind of new heights? And the answer, I suggest, is that they took away lessons from losing in America. And those lessons, I think, were summed up in what I call the spirit of 1783. And they included a new sense, really, of how to manage relations between the government and the people. and to manage them in ways that meant that people of all kinds of religions and ethnicities living all around the world could find a place within the hierarchy of the empire. They would have liberty up to a point. They would be held in check by institutions of the crown and its officers. And in this kind of balance, you saw a form of government that actually proved remarkably resilient and successful around the world. And it was the experience of having lost the colonies where this kind of balance didn't work out for Britain that helped them figure out where to go next and come up with what turned out to be a very successful formula moving forward into the 19th and 20th centuries.
It worked for a little while.
150-odd years is not so bad as a run of things at the top of the world.
And so I understand that this loyalism versus patriotism really did break up families, communities, other relations. How prevalent was this kind of division that occurred?
I think it was a lot more prevalent than we generally think, again. And the best example of this kind of division can be found in one of our dearest founding fathers, and that is Benjamin Franklin, whose own son, William Franklin, ended up being a very powerful leading loyalist, as important to the loyalist community as Benjamin Franklin was to the patriot community. And here was a rift between father and son created by the war, and it just drove a wedge between them. And so while Benjamin Franklin was managing American affairs diplomatically through the war, and ultimately negotiated the peace settlement that defined U.S. independence, William Franklin was arrested by the Patriots, jailed for some time, spent time in British-occupied New York City organizing loyalist resistance to Patriot forces, and ended up spending the end of the war himself in exile in Britain and ending up on the losing side. But the passions that were ignited by this war were, I think, very strong, and the principles people had in the case of the Franklins, you know, could be very powerful, and it really could divide even this very close father and son. I think that that's a kind of story that we need to remember. I think we tend to think of ourselves as having always been a very united people, but to remember the ways in which we weren't always united is very important for us as we live through an era of seeming partisanship in our country today.
The big question that arose for me reading your book is how this history impacts our understanding of historic America and the founding of America in the American Revolution. It kind of shakes it up a bit. What would you say the impact is?
There are two aspects to this that I really believe are important. One is that America really was based on wonderful principles and promises and rhetoric. And yet, we have never been a monolithic society. We have always been a society with many, many voices, very plural, very multi-ethnic. I believe that that's very much a source of our strength, but it's also, of course, been a source of tension historically right the way through our national history, the Civil War being a great example. So the importance of remembering that even at the outset we had all kinds of divisions might make it easier for us somehow to accept that we're going to continue to be divided, and that's part of what makes us who we are. We share some values, we're going to debate them, and we're going to fight about them, and that's part of what we're about. So for me, that, I think, is a really important lesson in thinking about the American Revolution from this other perspective. The second point is also very important for America right now, and that is that we have long really been proud of what makes our national history so special and so distinctive. But our national history has always been in a larger international context. And you know, one of the things about the Loyalist refugees is that American influences through these people ended up spreading out across the world. And it's just a really important reminder that our history has always been bound up with the histories of other nations. Our history has always put us in this bigger world context. And as we figure out who we are in the world today, who we can be, who we're going to be, it's, again, really important to think through the ways that our history has always been an international one as well.
Where did you find these loyalist refugees going?
They ended up fanning out right across the British world. This is a big defeat for Britain, but Britain bounces back in some really amazing ways. And one of the things that Britain does right after losing the colonies is that it starts expanding elsewhere. So, for example, Australia is first settled just a couple of years after American independence, and the very first proposal to settle Australia was put forward by an American loyalist. So after the war, in this remarkable mass evacuation of civilians from British-held cities, New York, Charleston, Savannah, something like 60,000 loyalists go off into the British Empire and settle really everywhere that Britain had a foothold, whether it's Canada, the Caribbean, West Africa even, Australia, and of course Britain itself.
Did you see some returning to the United States?
There is some of that. And above all, rather than a kind of mass return, which I didn't see, I saw continued connections. And I think, again, this speaks to the way in which America and Britain always shared more than divided them, that loyalists who left, settled in Canada, for example, or the Bahamas or Britain, kept up family ties, kept up ties of friendship, of business with their peers and relatives and friends back in the United States. And these connections would go on to be called, and in Britain certainly, the foundation of the special relationship, as it's termed now. But for these individuals, it really was a kind of personal relationship that they retained around the British world. And we all speak English. We all share certain kinds of values. And I think that these loyalist refugees helped kind of create the human fabric of that special relationship.
And did you find there was an impact of the loyalists moving to these other parts? Say, you mentioned some went to Sierra Leone, for example.
Yeah, no, very much so there was an impact. That was probably what I was most surprised by. But in fact, what I found is that these people did side with Britain, yes. But when they went off into the British Empire, they found sometimes that what they wanted was not the same as what the British government was giving them. You end up finding these really remarkable cases of loyalists going off to places like Canada saying, we want more representation in our government. We don't want to pay taxes. And that sounds an awful lot like what American patriots were saying back in the colonies. So the loyalists in this sense, I think, really do bring with them a kind of, if you will, American sentiment into parts of the British Empire. And I think it did have an impact in helping to shape how British government worked overseas. And they brought other things with them, too. They brought everything from their personal possessions, of course, and recipe books and things like that, to faith, even. And one of the most remarkable sets of people that I followed in my book were these black loyalists who were Baptist preachers who had all been part of a congregation together in the backcountry in South Carolina. And after the war, they end up dispersing all over the Atlantic and found Baptist churches in Canada, in Jamaica, in the Bahamas, in Sierra Leone. And, you know, this is a great example of how languages coming out of America, people coming out of America, have this incredible sort of global impact through the British Empire.
Well, Maya Jazanoff, thank you so much for being with us. The name of the book is Liberty's Exiles, American Loyalists in the Revolutionary World.
Great to talk with you.
When we come back, William Grider joins us to discuss America at a political, cultural, and economic crossroad. Stay tuned. You are listening to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. Our next guest says that America is at a crossroads, culturally, economically and politically, and its advancement or decline depends on which way it goes. William Grider is author of Who Will Tell the People, Secrets of the Temple, and Come Home, America, The Rise and Fall and Redeeming Promise of Our Country. Welcome back, Bill Grider.
Thank you, Maria.
I want to start with, I think it's your second sentence in this book, and you said, beyond recession and financial crisis, we are in much deeper trouble than many people suppose or the authorities want to acknowledge. How deep is the trouble?
I think we are at an historic turning point in our country's history. I mean, and it will be profoundly changing in the way Americans live and how we think about ourselves. We are going to learn humility, which is not one of our strongest traits. We are going to face facts that do not yield to our bravado or can-do spirit. And it's going to be hard. It's going to be a hard passage for Americans, both in economic terms, but also it's going to force us to give up on some comforting illusions about ourselves and the world. And, you know, this long-running notion that because we're so good and great and powerful and good-hearted, we get to run the world, and the other countries will fall in line because we are so good. And, you know, that's sustained a lot of good stuff, I think, but also it has powered the fact that we're such a overbearing and awesomely armed country that does, in fact, use its power to bend people to our will. That's over. I mean, if not instantly, of course, but I think the idea of America as number one is over, and people should get used to that.
Now, you said that there are five elements that are driving a deterioration. Let's go through them quickly, and then we'll detail them. Globalization.
Globalization, the way the United States has approached it, has gravely weakened American economic strength. That's expressed most clearly in the giant trade deficits. But people, I think, everywhere also glimpse it when they see long-established manufacturing sectors steadily undermined, either by moving production elsewhere or simply unable to compete with low-wage workers on the other end of the system. A second, maybe a little harder for people to see, is the mass consumption society, which we have all enjoyed one way or another for really the last 50 or 60 years, is now, I think, doomed in the sense that it has to change and will be changed by events. And that's a combination of the ecological crisis, global warming and other dimensions, but also the scarcity of oil. And this is now in discussion, at least in popular politics, for the first time seriously in many decades, which is good, but I don't think people have yet grasped what the depth of the transformation that this is going to produce. Another dimension would be militarism, and I use that word with hesitation, but it really is about relying on our military power to shape our foreign policy, and that has created these vast deployments all over the world, some of them well-known and visible, but a lot of them actually clandestine in the form of special forces, Green Berets, and so forth. And I argue, again, with some hesitation, but I conclude that the military institution in the United States is now probably the gravest threat to our peace and security because it's created those tripwires, because it's literally circling the globe looking for somebody to punch it in the chin. And guess what? That happens, doesn't it? I'm really nervous on that level, and I'm trying to make it clear I'm not indicting even admirals and generals or the military institution per se, because it's filling a vacuum which was allowed and encouraged for many years during the Cold War. And instead of backing off and saying, wait a minute, this is out of balance, this is way too much and dangerous, we keep stumbling forward. And there are a couple of more, but the one that is fundamental to everything else is the dysfunctional democracy. And again, people at large know this, and they've known it for years, that we have our representative democracy is not functioning. It's wildly out of balance. Powerful interests of various kinds dominate and in some ways hold a veto power over the elected government, and the elected Congress, for instance, more or less goes along with that, unable or afraid to resist. And the party that's left out are the people. and I mean that broadly, and I'm not making distinctions between liberals and conservatives or young or old or rich or poor. It's a general condition. The two parties are both failing in those terms, and again, it's a bipartisan indictment. Finally, Maria, not to monopolize, but the hard part of what I'm trying to explain, and the most important part, is that we won't get out of this whole and equitably and create a better country on the other side if the people do not step up and assert themselves as citizens. And I know that sounds implausible to a lot of cynical people, but that's the way American history has always worked.
I want to get back to that, but I wanted to go through some of these a little bit more in detail. So if we were, for example, going to start with the globalization issue and the economic issue, you also talked about in your book about the free market ideology and how that's affecting everything from culture to the economic system. And if we tie it into what's going on today, so you've said, look, this economic crisis was not a perfect storm, as Wall Street would like everybody to believe. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about this.
Yes. Well, you could make a case that our financial crisis, which was really inflated valuations and sometimes often fraudulent valuations, building up debt in the society at a level that was crazy, really, when you look back on it. And part of the reason that the financial system could do that is because the country was sinking into debt through the trading system. And it's not just enough to say that some steel workers and some auto workers or others were hurt by jobs moving offshore. It was the economy overall that has been gravely weakened. And so that produces those sort of weird imbalance where the financial sector gets larger and larger, even as the productive sector is not. Now that's, you know, anybody who understands the relationships in capitalism knows that's out of whack. What happened, I believe, and I assert in the book, is that because of our distinctive position, we won World War II, we helped reorganize the peace, and we relaunched global trade, all, you know, created the UN, all virtuous things. But that led eventually to a kind of self-glorifying arrogance, to put it bluntly. And we then engaged global trade in a way that was different from every other advanced industrial economy. All of those countries, whether you're talking about Japan or Germany or France or many others, insisted that their multinationals keep a set of obligations to the home country. And that was about keeping the good jobs there. It was about keeping a balance with the rest of the world. And they all struggled with the same pressures. The United States was distinctive because our government and our private sector promoted and advanced the notion that our national interest would be served if our U.S. multinationals did well in the world, and everybody else would somehow benefit from that. Well, that has been demonstrably not true for many years, and yet it's still pretty much the core belief of the governing elites in charge. And I'm including Democrats as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I can recall, you know, finding Democrats carrying bills to subsidize advertising overseas for fast food chains.
Right. And the, you know, the tax issues, which Obama raised, have been around for 30 plus years. What's rare is that a Democratic president has the courage to stand up and raise it again.
And one of the other issues that you have brought up in this book, and you've written an entire tome on it, is the Federal Reserve. And you say this is one of the biggest culprits.
Yeah.
There's so much conspiracy theory out there around the Federal Reserve and its mystique. Can you give us a thumbnail sketch of this institution and what its role is in all this?
Well, I did write this rather long book, if you're familiar with.
Secrets of the Temple, right in front of me.
20 years ago, and I'm happy, proud to say that it's still selling in the marketplace. In fact, the sales have bumped up in the last year or two because people are grasping that they better understand this institution better. The Fed is deliberately cloaked in obfuscation and mystique, and it's cloistered from political accountability. And, of course, that feeds conspiratorial theories about who really runs things and so forth and so on. I try to get past those because, having spent a lot of time running through them, there's some factual truth in some of what the critics say. The problem is when you've cleared away all of the complications, the Federal Reserve is part of the federal government. It's different from the rest of the federal government, mainly because it is protected from political accountability. And that was quite deliberate. When they created the Fed in 1913, that was the banking system saying, we need a central bank to keep us from crashing every couple of years. And so the central bank was positioned between capital and labor, basically. And it was supposed to balance between those two pressures. It was shielded from public accountability because the fear of the financiers was that, well, if you let the unruly public have something to say about this, they will immediately push for easy credit and too much money, and we'll wind up with inflation. And, of course, what the Fed did in the last generation, and did it was all in broad daylight, they pushed the opposite way. They shifted the balance. Instead of being moderating force, they shifted the balance hard in front of capital and financial wealth. And against labor. They suppressed wages by keeping money tight and literally keeping the economy from growing as fast as it was ready to grow. And on the other side, they stripped away the regulations and the prudential rules that control the financial system and the banking system from going crazy. And they said, hey, there's no tomorrow. Let's go for it. You guys are the titans of finance, and you know what you're doing, and we will step back and not really interfere with your own plans to, quote, modernize the system. Well, I've been writing this in various forms ever since I wrote that book in 1987 when I described the triumph of money, as I put it in the last chapter. And candidly, it didn't get much response from anybody in official positions, to put it mildly, because everybody was riding the same train, saying, this is wonderful. Look at the Dow Jones. Look at the expanding financial wealth. And I was one of those bag ladies on the street corner saying, it's all an illusion, and it's going to come down with great wreckage and pain.
You have, at the end, written 6 imperatives to guide transformation and restore well-being.
Oh, gosh, do I remember?
Well, I'll start you.
Start me. First thing.
Number one, you say, is we've got to restore a moral principle and a public obligation to corporations. Now, you and I actually met at a quasi-think tank group that dealt with this very issue.
Yes.
So how might we approach this restoring moral principle and public obligation to corporations?
Well, the good news is that a lot of people inside corporations know this failing, and they are advocates themselves, at least in their quiet way, for profoundly reforming the corporate institution. And that has to be done by rule of law, but it also has to be done by individuals, not just the managements or even the shareholders, although they can be part of this, but the employees who work there at every level, by suppliers, by customers. The phrase I use in the book is we have to thicken democracy. And by that I mean building the kind of structure of rules and obligations that allow most every sector and stakeholder to participate, not just listen to speeches, but to actually be at the table participating in the decision-making. And this is crucial, informing the people at the top of the ladder, the managers, the CEO, of realities that they do not see. There's nothing fancy about this idea. It's actually a picture of a healthy democracy. But it does not exist, for the most part, in our workplaces, in a lot of our largest and most powerful institutions. Here's the thing, that people want to get into fights between liberals and conservatives. I know, because I've traveled around the country, you will get people, I don't care what their party label or ideological perspective is, you will get people to agree with that, to just say, of course, this society is organized top-down, not in every respect, but in most respects. And that's not what this country was founded for. We've been here at it for a couple hundred years, and we'll be at it many more, pursuing that goal. But that's the American ideal that we ought to revive now and make active.
The basis of what you're saying here is that for so long we've been trading off this kind of living, about things that are meaningful, trading it off for maximizing profit and wealth and getting ahead and this kind of mass consumerism, making more than the next guy or whatever that happens to be.
And one of the things that I think is, and people know this, but one of the things that's askew in our country is that process actually, at least for the last generation, has produced deepening insecurity.
Yeah, no doubt.
And even fear. Not the pleasurable life that it supposedly promises. But nevertheless, one way or another, most all of us are trapped in that, because how do you step back from it? It's not easy, right? And I think people make that choice, but it's very hard. And I am not one of those people who recommends a simple life. You know, we go back to nuts and berries and living without cars or whatever. But we do need to talk about how we can turn the pressure down and give people more space in their lives. And I use the phrase, trying to answer that question you read, of what do you tell people when the good times ain't coming back? What can you offer them? And my answer is larger lives.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily a function of wealth or even material goods, but a function of power. Do people have the power over their own lives to seek things which are not necessarily the high end of income, but are the fulfilling things they want to do with their lives? You know, the other thing, when I've had this conversation with younger people, it really rings the bell with them, Maria, because they don't see, I mean, they just came into the story, right? They weren't here 50 years ago or even 30 years ago. They're young and their eyes are open and they can see what's around them. And they just seem like, well, of course, that's what we want. Not everybody under 30 makes that choice, obviously. And many people can't make that choice. They have to work two jobs or, you know, whatever, to try to have a family and to keep the mortgage paid or the rent or whatever. I think this is a subject everybody could talk about with some expertise, because they've experienced elements of it. And I mean even people with affluent incomes. You hear it from them as well.
One of the most profound you make is about this, I think you called it the denial of the dignity of self-directed lives, where people at work, in the public sphere, at home, they don't have the ability to exercise the decisions in their own daily lives that govern their own daily lives. You called it command and control over our destinies.
Yeah.
And that people become accustomed to taking orders from people, and they get resigned and subservient.
Yes. And this woman who called me the other day, who sent me the midnight email or the 3 a.m. email, her name is Gina, and those are things that Gina mentioned. This is an old idea. It's not a new idea. And people in organized labor were saying this 150 years ago. People need to own their own work. And I don't mean own necessarily in a, you know, I've got a title or even a contract, but an understanding that whatever work you do, you should have self-direction. That doesn't mean there are no bosses. It doesn't mean that it's anarchy. It just means that the process and the decision-making surrounding your work, you should have a voice in that. And the best companies, as we know, do that, because they understand that engaging people, whether they're in the front office or the assembly line or out back in the garage, brings their knowledge and their talents more directly into the production process itself. So this is not pro or con capitalism or even corporations, but it does require you to reorganize those.
Right. It is definitely linked to the current system of the employment sector.
Yeah.
I wonder if this is the optimum time to see some of these changes that you're talking about. And there are some alternative models that you talked about in this book, Come Home America. And some of these are new social enterprises, the social corporation, kind of democratic co-ops.
I feel a very strong conviction that employee ownership in one form or another, either by direct share ownership or cooperative arrangements or others, is part of our way out of this command and control society. You've heard me go through
examples.
There are many of them in California, by the way. usually younger, smaller companies. Silicon Valley had elements of this from the start, although they didn't usually include everybody. They included the, you know, the techies and the people in the front office, not necessarily the people doing assembly, but they could. I mean, this is hard to do. You're asking people, both the employees, workers, bosses, to change themselves. They have to change rather deep inherited attitudes toward power. Who gets to talk? Who gets to participate?
You know, and unfortunately, people don't really have knowledge about things like cooperatives and how to build cooperatives and that kind of a thing, worker-owned companies. We're just, that has not been a model that we have been looking at.
Well, there's a lot of them around, you know. There are a couple million of them if you start counting, surprisingly more numerous. And there are a lot, and there's something like 11,000, I think. Is that right? Or 11 million? 11,000, I think. Directly employee-owned companies. And that's through employee share ownership trusts and so forth and so on. These were ideas 100 years ago and more recently than that. So you're right. I'm agreeing with you that element of American culture was kind of snuffed out for different reasons, including the arrangements even created in the New Deal years allowed the big companies to get bigger, 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 and then to monopolize, if not in the pure legal sense, in the predatory sense, right? And you see a lot of this in California as well, where the small innovative companies get to a certain size and they're proving that they know something the big guys don't know, and they're succeeding and they're profitable. And at some point, they hit not a ceiling exactly, but a sort of critical moment when the big capital, the larger companies, will step up and buy them out or try to push them out or respond in different ways, where many owners at that stage, quite understandably, say, let's get our capital out and give it up because we can't compete with these big guys the way the rules work now.
I think the crisis is an opportunity for people to step back from the way things have worked in this country for a lot of years, two or three, four decades, and ask, okay, what is our vision? And what I'm trying to do, Maria, is coax people out of their resignation and their sense of hopelessness and say, you've got a right to dream a little bit now. What do you think the society should become? Obviously, I think my ideas are the best, but that's not the point of the book. The point of the book is to jar people into thinking what they would see in the future. Out of that process becomes power for citizens, but you can't skip over it. You can't simply wait till somebody delivers a speech and tells you what to think.
We're speaking with William Grider. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Maria.
William Grider is author of Who Will Tell the People?, Secrets of the Temple, and Come Home, America, The Rise and Fall and Redeeming Promise of Our Country. When we come back, Heather Rogers on green solutions. Are they helpful or harmful? Stay tuned.
Well, get your dirty hands off my Constitution now.
You are listening to The Insiders, offering insight into today's most pressing issues. And I'm Maria Armudian. Over the past few years, more and more green solutions have emerged to address environmental crises. But our next guest says that some of these amount to lazy environmentalism, and may have a dark side effect of camouflaging a larger problem. Heather Rogers argues that our current socioeconomic system depends on pollution to maintain its own well-being. And if so, what are the real solutions? Heather Rogers joins us now. She's a journalist and author of Green Gone Wrong, How Our Economy is Undermining the Environmental Revolution. Welcome.
Thank you, Maria.
I want to actually start with this concept of lazy environmentalism.
Sure.
And what you mean by it.
Right. It's not a term that I coined. It's something that has some currency in the newer generation of environmentalism, which eschews the guilt, you know, and the sacrifice of, you know, the environmentalism that came up in the 1970s. It's the 40th anniversary of Earth Day, saying, okay, we don't have to suffer. We can live in nice houses and we can live well and we can drive where we want to drive in hybrid cars and enjoy ourselves. And we can use the market mechanisms in order to have a good life and save the planet. I don't know if that really works.
So you actually argue that you don't think it does at all and might even make it worse in some ways.
Well, what happens is the way that the market works is that it has to grow. And in order to do that, it has to utilize materials in nature. It can't stop extracting and affecting the natural environment, ecosystems that we need in order to hold back climate change, in order to keep our water clean and diverse species all over the planet. What I'm saying is that, you know, there's this fundamental logic that we can't undo by replacing green products for dirty ones. You know, that fundamental logic is still there, where wealth comes from.
It still comes from the ground and it still comes from nature. And I wonder if it's just a part of being human that we are exploiting nature. How do you counteract that?
Right. We have to use resources. And what I argue at the end of the book is that, you know, I'm not saying we don't take anything from nature, because we do. And we have an interrelationship with nature. There's a term for it, socioecology. It's this idea that social networks and environmental networks do coexist. We've always used nature to support life,
yeah.
Right? So how can we do that without wrecking the place? And we know that it can be done because societies have done it in the past. Current societies are doing it, you know, to varying degrees now. And it's just a matter of looking beyond the role of ourselves as individual consumers and the choices that we make and looking at the larger picture.
So what you're not arguing is that people should stop doing the green things like the reusable bags and the reusable cups and any of that. You're not arguing that. You're saying it just may not be enough.
But there are some, you know, quote unquote, green products that are really bad.
Let's talk about some of those. You talked about a few of them. Some of them include this label of organic food, and sometimes it's a little deceptive.
I would say that locally grown organic food environmentally is very sound. I looked also at globally grown organic. Increasingly, as big corporations take over the organic food industry, they are sourcing organic inputs from all over the world, developing countries primarily. So I ended up in Paraguay on an organic sugar plantation, which supplies a third of all the organic sugar consumed in the United States. This plantation is doing things like clearing trees, clearing native ecosystem to expand its organic cropland. This doesn't make environmental sense. It makes economic sense. And yes, they're not spraying the crops with chemicals, and that's better, but they're pulling apart these vital ecosystems that can't be replaced, at least not anytime soon. Biofuels, for example, the government mandates consumption of biofuels in this country, in Europe, in parts of China, and in many other countries around the globe. It's increasingly popular because it's seen as a green, renewable energy. What's happening in places like Indonesian Borneo, where I went and spent some time in the rainforest and some indigenous villages, is that they are clear-cutting one of the last large remaining rainforests on the planet to grow crops for biofuels. Where I was the last remaining viable habitat for the orangutan.
You actually visited one farm that you considered kind of beyond organic, the Morse Pitts, mm-hmm. Windfall Farms in New York, and he was really struggling.
Yeah.
So talk to us about the broader implications of that.
This is the other side of the economics of organic. The small local farmer is hailed as the hero of this wave of environmentalism and the transformation of the food system. And what I found is that so many of these farmers have a really hard time making ends meet, even though they charge quite a bit of money for the produce that they make, but their costs are so high and there's such a dearth of infrastructure for them. The most recent farm bill, $300 billion, the vast majority of that goes to conventional, polluting, scorched earth agriculture. It doesn't go to supporting holistic systems that are community-based and that are local. And if we could start to reorient those priorities, it would make a tremendous difference. And it would make that food much more accessible and much more affordable for regular people.
But let me just remind listeners that we're speaking with Heather Rogers. She's written a book called Green Gone Wrong, How Our Economy is Undermining the Environmental Revolution. These independent, quasi-independent agencies that certify, they also have these huge corporations like Cargill and Archer Daniel Midland on the board. Did you have a sense that that is just compromising their standards?
Corporations were founding members, and it was a partnership that they entered into with the World Wildlife Fund. And there are some other environmental groups that participate. One of the plantations I visited where this plantation company is illegally deforesting, they're making refining palm oil, which they sell to a company called Wilmar, which is partially owned by Archer Daniels Midland. So you have this dispossession of native indigenous communities, absolutely wiping out of this rainforest and burning the trees once they've been cut down. And that kind of forest clearance has made Indonesia the third largest CO2 emitter globally. This is a country without developed industries. It trails only the U.S. and China in its CO2 emissions because of all the deforestation.
You are not somebody who says more regulation is really going to help. You address the socially responsible business kind of approach, that what you even call the triple bottom line. And it sounded like you didn't have a lot of faith in it.
I don't, because I think there's a fundamental misunderstanding of the economic system. There's a critique in this. It's often referred to as natural capitalism or green capitalism. Natural capitalism says, well, we need the government to come in. So natural capitalism is an interpretation of capitalism that says you can clean up the environment, you can green your business, and all of this will save you money, make your enterprise more efficient, and it will win over customers. And in this economic system, because it does have to grow, that energy goes back into expanding the business and intensifying, you know, making new markets and further intensifying consumption. So it's not like you retire those savings. So when Walmart replaces its truck fleet with more fuel-efficient vehicles, it's not like the greenhouse gases that aren't being made are just put away. Walmart opens another store and another store and another store.
Let's talk about ecological housing units that you saw in Europe. You seemed inspired by them.
You know, I look at what's not working, but I also look at what's working. I went to Germany to the town of Freiburg, which is referred to often by people as an eco-village, housing a total of 15,000 people. They've been around for over a dozen years, and so they have this track record. You know, is it comfortable, weird? You know, is it like culturally kind of alienating? And what I found was that it was very accessible, and it's different for different people, of course.
What is it about it that works?
What works is that they've built buildings using passive house methods, which is a super insulated building method and very well-made components that hold as much energy in Germany. About 3/4 of all CO2 emissions come from heating of the building emissions. So it's really important to have really well-insulated structures. There's also buildings in this neighborhood that actually produce more energy than they use. They all have solar panels as their roofs. And something that the German government is doing is they have this thing which is called the feed-in tariff. How it works is regular people can put solar panels on their house. They plug those solar panels into the grid, and the utility is obliged to buy power from them for 20 years at double the going rate. So that means that individuals can pay off their solar panels in 7 to 8 years, and then they get a dozen years of pure profit. So it becomes financially doable for them, because with renewable energy, all the costs are up front. And with coal, we get to spread those costs out over time. And it's not it's not something that the government is paying for in Germany. All the ratepayers chip in, so everyone's participating. I'm not totally opposed to regulation. I think that everything kind of plays a role, but there has to be ways that we use all the different, you know, mechanisms that we have in ways that make the most sense.
Okay, and now let's end with transportation. And one of the things that you're critical of is the carbon offset. First of all, talk about what the carbon offset is and what your considerations are. Where do we go from here?
So carbon offsetting is available to regular consumers. It's a voluntary product that we can buy. When you get an airplane ticket, say, there's often now an option on the website to say, you know, offset my carbon from this flight and pay $10 or $15 extra. And that money goes to a company that then partners with nonprofits typically on the ground in places most often in developing countries. China and India are the number one sites of carbon offset projects. I went to India, where a quarter of all the world's offsetting projects are being carried out. And what I found is that, you know, it sounds great. I emitted this carbon. I paid this money. Now my conscience is clear. Except it doesn't quite work like that. Carbon can only be neutralized over time. So if you plant a tree, it's not until the full lifespan of that tree is over that carbon has been absorbed. That might take 100 years. And clearly we need carbon to be reduced now. And then there are other issues with carbon offsetting, like do the projects actually get carried out at all? There can be really unintended consequences. One of the places I went to was a renewable energy plant that was supposed to run on crop wastes. And what was happening is that it's in this very poor farming region, and people are cutting down trees to sell to the plant to earn extra money. There's all kinds of possible snags that are really hard to anticipate when you're sitting at your computer and you want to do the right thing. What we need to do, I think, is to really not accept an oversimplification of the situation we're in and why we're here. From what I saw on the ground, carbon offsetting, it can't take carbon out of the atmosphere.
Tell us how we should approach this now.
We need to practice our environmentalism in a range of ways, not just through what we buy. Part of that environmentalism, the way that we can practice it is by educating ourselves. I think if we can expand environmentalism to include the social, we see environmental crisis so in such a compartmentalized way. And I think if we can start to open that up and understand the connections between the social, the economic, and the environmental, we can really start making some progress that is based on hope and not based on false hope.
Thank you, Heather Rogers. The book is called Green Gone Wrong, How Our Economy is Undermining the Environmental Revolution. Thank
Maria,
you so much.
Thank you.
That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to the Scholar Circle team who makes this show possible, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Leonardo Alanis, and Joe Pinto. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed a part of the show, you can go back either to the kpfk.org audio archives, or you can go to scholarcircle.org. You can hear us on iTunes and on Stitcher, and you can follow me at @Armudian.